This week's parsha is Vayechi, and we officially conclude reading, studying Sefer Bereishis. But I actually want to begin tonight by going to the next Sefer, to next week's parsha of Shmos, when we are told very early on in the beginning of the Sefer, Vayakom Melech Hadash al Mitzrayim, a new king rose over Egypt, Asher Lo Yadas Yosef, who did not know Yosef. Rashi famously gives two opinions. Was this literally a new king, or was this the same king, but he chose to forget Yosef? And whatever it is, right away we're told that this king has is very suspicious about the Jewish people. Am b'nei Yisrael, rav atzum mimenu. They're getting a large number, and he's nervous that they're going to join some other invading nation and maybe cause the Egyptians all these problems. One thing leads to the next, and before you know it, the Jews are enslaved, and the terrible affliction and slavery of Egypt unfolds, and is of course famously described then in the in Parshas Shmos. What I want to do this evening is now go back to a Sefer Bereishis, and you know the question always is, and I'm studying this year with some students. At in school and high school students, we're studying American Jewish history, and you know we ask the question, why is it important to study American Jewish history? What value besides one just having an interest in that topic? But why else would it be necessary of importance to study American Jewish history? And so, at the beginning of the year, one of the students had a beautiful suggestion. He said that, but well, we need to understand American Jewish history to understand what has allowed Jews in America to be successful over the years. Also, you know, what were the factors that led to, unfortunately, we know a lot of assimilation in America. And the reason why it's important to know all that is to see whether what the future will be in America. In other words, are the conditions going to continue, or the conditions, are they changing, that therefore perhaps predicts that whatever the situation has been until now may be different moving forward. And I think it's a very insightful observation by this student. And I think that that's also important in retrospect and looking back at, you know, as we know what's going to happen in Sefer Shmos, the question is, do we begin to see signs of the fact that the Jewish people, from the perspective of the Egyptians, that there's this animosity, there's this hatred, there's this concern, there's this distinction, separation between the two people, that looking back at it, oh yeah, now I see, I put the pieces together. Now I can understand, not just, you know, there was this new king and out of nowhere, you know, everything was great until this point, and all of a sudden, like a total, you know, 180, that everything changes, or that no, the signs were there, and now I understand, you know, why everything else unfolded the way that it did. And this is like an important question again in general for, you know, for Jews. Always to ask ourselves, especially, you know, living in Gullis, living in exile, you know, do we have a future in terms of where we are? And do we need to make plans to move us somewhere else? And again, this has been an issue for Jews, unfortunately, you know, throughout our history and throughout the previous centuries, that Jews had to, you know, consider this. So that's what I want to do this evening. And again, I think it's very important, you know, to really see, you know, were there signs, were there not signs in advance that we could have picked up upon them. And again, I think it helps us in our own current times in terms of, you know, seeing the lay of the land, and to see, you know, what exactly are things that we need to be careful about, what are the opportunities that we have. So I want to take a step back, and I actually don't want to take a step back just to this week's parsha, but to actually to go all the way back to Parshas Noach to begin the story. Because if I remember correctly, the first time that Egypt is mentioned, the first time it's mentioned in the Torah, it could be already in. To check this out, maybe it's in Bavel, where it talks about, maybe when it talks about the original, the rivers that flowed out of Gan Eden. So I forget if it mentions Egypt in that context as well. I don't think it does. Let me just check quickly. When it describes Gan Eden, It tells us that, see, yeah, we got these different rivers. Tells us where these different rivers Pishon, Eretz HaChavilah, then we have Dolach, and the second river is the Gihon, which is the land of Cush. Then you have the Chideko, which is Ashur, and the Pras, was the fourth. Okay, so now it doesn't mention Egypt. But it does mention Egypt in Parshas Noach. Where does it mention Egypt? It tells us that there was a person by the name of Mitzrayim. And who is Mitzrayim? None other than the son of Ham. And he also happened to be the brother of Canaan. So right from the get-go, we're warned there's something not so wonderful about Mitzrayim, because he does not have the best of father and the best of brother. We already have learned about Ham and Canaan, about what they did to Noach. And again, that should just cause us some pause that this Mitzrayim, and clearly the Torah is always foreshadowing by mentioning these names, that there's something going to be not good about Mitzrayim. That's just clue number one. The second clue, the next time that we have Mitzrayim, the Egyptians, is of course when there's a famine in the land, and Avram decides to head south. And it's very telling that Avram is extremely concerned. He's concerned about Sarah's what's going to happen to Sarah, and as a result, what's going to happen to him. How does he know that? Right, he hasn't yet arrived in Egypt, and yet right away, you know, Avram immediately senses that there's a potential danger in going down to Mitzrayim. Clearly, this is not a good place to be, and he doesn't seem to have that concern in Canaan. Right, and not good things about the land of Canaan, it doesn't seem that he's concerned about his safety and about you know, what may happen to Sarah, but Sarah being abducted. He doesn't seem to have that concern in Haran, but in Egypt, this is something of grave concern for Avram. And in fact, that's the way it plays itself out. Right, that Sarah is abducted. Now, that's from Avram's perspective. What about from the Egyptian's perspective? So I think this is, again, this is all in retrospect. Like, you know, at the time, it's hard to see these things. But looking back, you know, you begin to see, oh, now I understand, you know, maybe why the Egyptians treat the Jews the way that they did. So, you know, Paro, you know, abducts Sarah. And Hashem, of course, wants to protect Sarah. So he causes these nika'im, these types of afflictions to affect Paro and his household. And then what happens? The Torah says, got his own parshas Lech Lecha, by Krafar Oli Avram, by Yomer Mazosa Sisili. What did you do to me? Why aren't you truthful with me? Why don't you tell me that she was your wife? Lama Marta Chosi, why did you say she's my sister? Kachoso Lili Shar took her for her wife. Yata, and now Hinei Shecha, this is your wife. Kach Faleif, take her and get out of here. So, fast forwarding to when, you know, ultimately Yosef and then Yaakov and the family comes down to Egypt, so one just wonders, you know, was this story passed down to the Egyptians as well? That, you know, look what this family in the past has done to us, right? You know, last time we dealt with this family, we were severely afflicted by them, right? There's some miraculous, most this unexplained, you know, plague impacted us. And, you know, they don't like us. Again, it's just it's another clue, but it presents the fact that there may be some animosity between the two. I may be reading to the next one, but the next time we're told about Egypt is when there's another famine, and Yitzchak, right, he wants to mimic his father and also go down to Egypt, and God forcibly tells him, "Al tiri Mitzrayim, don't go down to Egypt." And the way the Mefarshim understand that, don't go down to Egypt because, you know, you need to stay in the land. The land has been promised to you. Rashi famously says, quotes Chazal, that you know, Yitzchak has been brought as a korban. He's not allowed to, during that Kedesh Yitzchak, he's not allowed to leave Israel. But I'm reading it just al tirei Mitzrayim. Whatever you do, don't go down to Egypt, right? Stay far away from Egypt. Like it's not like Canaan's a great place to be either at the time, but don't go to Egypt. Right? Egypt is a bad place. We've talked about in the past, back to Parshas Lech Lecha, that Lot has a bad experience in Egypt. He's negatively influenced by what happens in Egypt. Stay away from Egypt. Okay, moving forward, we then get to the Yosef story. Okay, this is where things are now going to really, I think, play themselves out and really see this tension between the Egyptians and their attitude towards Yosef and Yaakov and his family. And some of these examples are more well known. So the Torah tells us the following. This is in Parsha Vayeshev. So first of all, it says the Yosef Hurad Mitzrayma. Yosef was brought down to Egypt, and not willingly, but he was had no choice, right? He was forced, brought down to Egypt, and then we're told that initially, when he first gets to Egypt, you know, it's terrible that he's away from his family, he's sold as a slave. But initially, it's like it's pretty good for him, right? He's working for Potiphar, and Potiphar, really respects him, and he puts him at the head of his household, and basically gives everything over to him. He completely trusts Yosef, and again, so far so good, right? Whatever Yosef did, Yosef is successful, and everything is great, right? Nasam biyado, his master gave everything over into his hand. Everything is wonderful. However, the Torah then tells us about his interactions with the wife of Potiphar, right? With all these problems, and yes, she tries to seduce him, and he refuses. And then the Torah tells us says the following. This is in Perek Lamed Tes, Pasuk Yudalad. Batikral Anshei Beisa, she screams out, calls out to the members of her house. Batomer Laham Limor, Ruhi Vi Lono Ish Ivri Letzachaik Banu. Look. And look at the Kiri's house, she describes him. She doesn't call him, you know, my you know, the master of the house, or the servant of my husband. She calls him rather Ish Ivri, a man who is an Ivri, has come to laugh at us. Letzachaik Banu. And the word Ivri, it's not the first time Ivri has appeared in the Torah. Avram has already been described as Avram HaIvri, when when he's told about that Lot being captured. But the expression Ivri is, you know, like the other, right? Ivri was like an Avra Hanar, that, you know, you're a foreigner, right? You know, foreigners are bad, right? We know that. I'm not getting into politics, but you know, foreigners and immigrants, and like, you know, we look down upon them. Despise them. They're not us. They're different, right? And they're there's this distaste and disgust and we want to distance ourselves from them. The Ramban, when using this expression, so he says, "V'tam ru'u hevi lanu ishivri ki ha'ivrim snuei ha'mitzrim hema." Because the Ivrim were hated, very strong term, the Ramban says, they were hated by the Egyptians. We'll see in a second how the Ramban knows that. He brings a Sukkim to prove that. But that's, here's the first time you see some interactions between the Egyptians and their attitude towards when the Jews are helping us out, so everything is good. I will see this more when Yosef's helped Paro, everything's wonderful. But the moment that they do something that we don't like, all of a sudden, they're different. They're despised. They're foreign. They're not one of us. And she calls them Ish Ivri. And again, the Mefarshim, she doesn't say Ish like what this person has done to me, but specifically uses this derogatory racist term, to describe Yosef. Okay, moving forward. So the next time that we see this interaction between Yosef and the Egyptians is Yosef, of course, is then thrown in jail, and he has he interprets the dreams of the baker and the butler. And then, beginning of Parshas Miketz, when Paro has his dreams, so here also there's a very strong Rashi here. The Rashi picks up on the language that is used. Remember, the butler, he has to remind Paro about that he was in prison, but he had this person that he met there who interpreted his dreams, and he says the following. Vishamitanu, and who was there with us in prison? Na'ar Ivri Eved Lesara Tabachim. A Na'ar, translated usually as like a young lad, in Ivri, that word Ivri again, the other, and Eved, a slave, the Sara Tabachim. So Rashi immediately says, Arurim HaRashayim, cursed is the wicked ones. This butler, the one he's sort of helping Yosef out, he's reminding Paro, but he's cursed. We curse him the way, in terms of what the way he described Yosef just now. Why? Because Maskira Balashim Bizayon, he mentioned Yosef in the most derogatory, demeaning terms. Na'ar, what does it mean? Na'ar, a youth? Shota. So there's one interpretation. He's a fool. I look at him as a fool. Ein Roy Lugdula, he's not fit for a position of greatness. Ivri, a fuel of Solnino Inomakir. He's not like us. He doesn't recognize our language. He's different. He looks different. His complexion is different. Evid, he's a slave. Right? He's a slave. Ain't Evid Molech, and a slave can never become a king, can never rule over us. So whether the father had negative feelings towards Yosef, or he felt the only way that Paro would except, to identify this person, that he'd have to use derogatory terms to introduce him to Paro. Nonetheless, again, you're seeing this culture that seems to be prevalent. This attitude, in terms of how the Egyptians are looking at this family of starting with Avram and now Yaakov and Yosef, how they are viewing that. Okay, so that's the next piece of evidence. And then, moving on in Parshas Miketz, skip a little bit. Torah then tells us the following. This is in Perek Mem Gimel Pasuk Lamed Beis. So now the brothers have come down, right? There's a famine in Israel, and they go down to Egypt, and I believe this is the second time they've come down. Now they've come back with Binyamin, and Yosef wants to feed them. So this is the pasuk that like everyone quotes. The Ramban, in fact, when he initially describes that word Ivri, so he cites this next pasuk. How do we know that the Egyptians don't like the Jews and that there's this they look down upon the family? So when Yosef has to feed them, he feeds the brothers, so we're told the following. That when they have a meal and Yosef is there, they don't know he's Yosef, and he's feeding the brothers, and also all the Egyptian officers are there as well, his servants. He sits them up, they seat them all separately. Right? They're not at the same table. It's sort of like sometimes unfortunately you have a simcha, right? And there's certain family members don't talk to one another. So you got to put them at different tables, right? It's always like, the biggest headache, one of the biggest headaches, right? In planning, and so-and-so can't sit next to, the cousin so-and-so, right? So the Egyptians, you can't put the Egyptians at the same table as the Jews. So basically it has to do with kashrus, but the Torah tells us why they can't sit together. Because the Egyptians would refuse. They would not eat bread together with the Ivrim. Again, the Ivrim. Because it was an abomination to the Egyptians. To eat together would be an abomination. And Rashi here says, what exactly is the issue here? Davar sanoi hu lemitzrim. It'd be something of disgust that they want nothing to do. The Egyptians want nothing to do with Yaakov and with the family, with the Ivrim. Uncle says the issue is one of that we'll see this again repeated in a moment that if the Jews, right, they ate meat, and the Egyptians, that they worshiped these animals. So, you know, there's like this discussion, like, how could you, you know, eat our gods and that which we worship? Refers to something fascinating. Refers says, exact quote, refers says that, accordingly, very significant that already at the time when they hardly consisted of 70 persons, they were so characteristically prominent that they had a special national name. In other words, they're a small family. They're only 70 people, right? We know they're a small family, and yet they already they're very influential, right? You know, what he's saying is that, and this is, I think, repeats itself in Jewish history, that, you know, we're always a small nation. The Torah tells us we're always going to be a small nation. And yet our influence, you know, does, you know, so many people pointed this out, it doesn't, you know, in terms of numbers or percentage, you know, our influence and our impact is far greater than our numbers say that they should be. It's incredible, right? I'll ask my students when I meet with certain different groups, and I always ask, you know, how many people live in the world? The world population, it's like, let's say 7 billion, 8 billion, whatever it is right now. How many, you know, how many Christians are there? There's over a billion. How many Muslims? A billion. How many Jews are there? So if you ask a non-Jewish group, I've done this in the past, how many Jews are there in the world? What answer are you going to get? I've gotten this before. 500 million, you know, 300 million, 800 million, because they hear of Jews all the time. Right, in the media and then entertainment, they're always hearing about Jews. So they hear about Christians and Muslims. So there must be, like, you know, 500 million. And so when you tell them there's only 14 million Jews, they can't believe it. Right? They can't believe it. And yet the influence. So here there's only 70 members of Yaakov's family, if there is that, you know, that much right now. And yet the Egyptians still want nothing to do with them. Like they're insignificant. They're tiny. Who cares? And yet there's, right, it's like this age-old anti-Semitism, whatever it is, that there's this disgust and distaste, and there's this resentment and anger and animosity, and it's building up. I think that's what I'm trying to show you. You know, it's slowly building up this animosity, this hatred. There's a couple more examples. We're told that in a few more chapters. Now we're in Parshas Vayigash. So it's interesting, in Vayigash, right, when Yosef reveals himself, so what does he say, right? He reveals himself, and then he wants his brothers to go to Egypt, to go back to Canaan, to bring Yaakov, and the family should settle in Egypt. And we're told that Vayitav HaDavar, that in Paro's eyes, in base Paro, in the house of Paro, they're pleased the fact that the Jews are going to be settling here. So this seems to run counter to what I've just been saying. If they don't like them, why are they happy that they're living there? So you know why they're happy that they're living there, Nitziv says? Because they can use them, right? Because again, it's always this like love-hate relationship, that they know that the Jews being there will bring blessing, right? That economically, because if Yosef is so amazing, so if you have the whole family, a family full of geniuses, full of creative, intelligent, successful individuals, it's going to be wonderful. But again, that's also is anti-Semitic, you know, because it's lumping us all in a group and assuming that we're all the same, and again, using us for their benefit, for their purpose. And the Tziv develops that idea. And now the other major pasuk that really emphasizes this whole point. Now I'm in Perek Mem Vav Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Mem Vav Lamed Aleph. So now they come down to Egypt. The whole family is there. And we know that Yosef, right, he doesn't want them to live in Egypt proper, you know, in downtown Cairo. Where does he want them to live? In Goshen, in a separate area. Why? Because he doesn't want them to be influenced by the Egyptians. And therefore, how is he going to get convince Paro to do that? So he tells them, what should you tell them? When Paro asks what your job is, what should you tell them what you do for a living? Your accountants, your doctors, your lawyers, what do you do? We're roe, sow, and we're shepherds. and tell him that. Why should you tell him that? So the pasuk says, "Ki sov as Mitzrayim koroi tzon," because you know how the Egyptians, how they looked at the shepherding, it was an abomination to them. It's something you stay far, far away from. Right? That, like, you know, there's certain jobs like that's your job. That's what you do. And again, it's such an abomination because they worship these animals. And for the Jews, this is what they do professionally. And so, though, again, there's this, they're using the Jews, Yaakov's family, the Ivrim, but there's like, these people are not us. These people do things that disgust us in many ways. You know, we'll benefit from that. We'll take their money in there, what they do for us. But it's like the money lenders, right, in the Middle Ages. That you need the money lenders, you need the bankers to lend you the money, but it's considered to be a profession that's despised. You know, because you're charging interest and it comes back to bite someone and you're making all this money off of the interest. So you need it, but there's a reason why, you know, again, the Christians allow the Jews to have that given their profession, because it continued the narrative of who these you know who they are and how they perceive them in a very negative way. Now, in addition to this, and I think others who made this point, perhaps what increased the animosity and the disgust the Egyptians had for the Jews was Yosef's actions, which he may have had no choice. But you know, what is at the end of Vayigash, what does it describe, right? You know, Yosef has collected all the, you know, all the food, and there's famine, and Yosef is now, you know, was charged by Paro to sell the food not only to the foreigners but to the local Egyptians, and eventually they run out of money. And so ultimately, what does Yosef do? He has the Egyptians basically sell all their land to Paro, because all the land becomes state-controlled land, and he moves the people around to show them that they no longer live in the land. So if you're the Egyptians, and now you know this guy is Jewish, and he's the one who's causing you to lose, you know, all your land, you have no money, and you got to pay taxes to... How are you going to feel about Yosef and by extension, who he is, and you know what religion he's a part of? Right, probably not going to lend itself to good feelings. And so again, it's just another piece of the puzzle to understand why when Paro says, "Hey, we got to do something about these Jews." Yeah, we don't like these Jews, right? Because look what this one person, Yosef, you know, who's a Jew, look what he did to us. And then I think the clincher in all this, as we get now to our parsha, is that we're told the following, that when Yaakov dies, right? So Yaakov dies, and of course Yaakov, you know, wanted to be buried in Canaan, back in the land of Israel, and then Hebron, Maaseh Machpelah, right? So Yosef has to get permission from Paro to leave. And that's why the Ramban explains, that's why, you know, Yaakov understood that there would be some, wouldn't be so simple. That's why he made it, you know, Yosef swear. And therefore, when Yosef tells Paro that he swore, so therefore, you know, Paro sort of acquiesce. But he sends a whole entourage with Yosef and the brothers, not only for honor, but you also get the sense because we want to, you know, reel in the family. We don't want them to escape. We want to, keep them close. And again, Yosef has to, the language that he uses is in many ways, you know, very not befitting for him. You know, such royalty, and you think he had such a, you know, good relationship with Paro and all that he had done for Paro. And yet, what does Yosef say? If I found favor in your eyes. What, he hasn't found favor in their eyes? Look what he's done for them over these past years. He literally saved their lives. If it wasn't for Yosef interpreting the dreams, they all would be dead. There would be no food. So if I found favor in your eyes, let me please speak in the ears of... Like, clearly, again, there's this tension that is brewing. And there's this... So I think, you know, putting this all together is that you have, you know, look at... It's hard to see it in the moment, but in retrospect, looking back... You know, the pieces were there, and the evidence was there, and the signs were there, that lends itself to what's now going to happen in next week's parsha. And this is always the challenge that we have, you know, whether it's, you know, God forbid, anti-Semitism and exile, or even, you know, smaller things in our lives, you know, things with our children and things with within a marriage and relationships and, you know, in business. You know, are we able to see the signs, you know, good or bad, that should you know, make us aware that something is amiss, or something, you know, good is about to occur. Are we open? Are our eyes, are we paying attention, you know, to the clues and to the events as they're unfolding, as, you know, as what they're sort of, you know, telling us in terms of what's going to happen. Again, because often in life, you know, people look, oh, there were things that were happening, I just didn't pay attention. You know, God forbid, sometimes like a marriage falls apart. You know, I always said, had the couple like noticed it like 3 years earlier, that they could have dealt with it. Right? They could have gotten help. They could have gotten, you know, they gone to therapy, and they could have worked things out. But they didn't see, you know, what's happening until 3 years later. You know, all of a sudden, you know, they're completely two different people, and they're totally disconnected. And like, what happened? Oh, what happened? You look back, you can see exactly what happened. And it wasn't so bad initially, but again, you didn't pick up on the signs, on the clues. Again, it's like anything else in life. You know, those things happen. So sometimes some things are not so major, but other times they are extremely significant. And you know, and obviously the challenge is that sometimes, you know, we see things and they're not, you know, we make them out more than they need to be, and they're not as bad. So like, you know, it's hard to that's why life is so hard and complicated, because you know, sometimes it's nothing, but other times it is something. So that's why we daven to Hashem for wisdom. Right? That's the first bracha we daven. That's why Shlomo Melech, right? He asked for wisdom, right? That's because you need mazel, right? You need some good luck. You need luck, and you need the hashkacha, Hakadosh Baruch Hu, obviously helping you and assisting you. But you also need to use you know, the chachma, your brain and our intelligence that God has gifted to us. You know, to make the best decisions possible, and you know, and sometimes it's too, you know, sometimes the signs, you know, people always ask, you know, about, you know, the, enough with this, you know, with the Jews, you know, in Germany, you know, before, you know, the Holocaust, didn't they see what was happening? You know, didn't they see what was happening? So sometimes you see, but you know, you hope for the best, and sometimes you've seen this in the past, and it didn't, you know, turn into a Holocaust. You know, it's not always, or like, you know, it wasn't really so simple just to get out and pick yourselves up and go somewhere else. And so, you know, those are the tough questions. You know, those are the really hard ones that sometimes, you know, it's, you know, what's before you is so, you know, difficult and so painful, or, you know, again, the marriage falling apart, the, you know, issues with a child, or the God forbid, you know, the anti-Semitism and, you know, persecution and exile. That you know, sometimes, you know, we do need to be aware of those signs, and sometimes need to make drastic changes to avoid, you know, the inevitable, because all the signs are there. Again, it's not an easy thing to do, but you know, perhaps, you know, this is another lesson of Sefer Bereishis, that the Torah is, you know, is already showing us that that the Egyptian exile, the Egyptian bondage, was beginning to unfold. It's not as shocking as it maybe appears to be. The beginning of Sefer Shemos, and we'll read next week. And actually, you can begin to see it in Parshas Vayechi. Obviously, in the case of you know, with Yaakov and his family, it was decreed. It was going to happen one way or the other. That was a covenant that, you know, God makes with Avraham, Bris Bin Absarim. But again, it is a lesson to us in our own lives, seeing the signs, and then you know, having the wisdom to not deceive them, but then to understand, you know, how to best to proceed and respond upon those things that appear before us. Okay, hope everyone has a wonderful Shabbos.